In our studies together, we are tonight coming to chapter 14 for Sunday morning. It's verses 1 through 16. And by the way, in case I forget to send out the email for the evening service, it's going to be verses 7 to 11 in 1 Peter 4. I'll try and send out a reminder email of that. But for tonight, we're in Genesis 4, verses 1 through 16. If you've had a chance to look over it, it's one of those passages you think, where are the goodies in this one? Okay, so we'll get to that. But let's start with some of our observational approach. In verse 1, it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations. So really quickly, give me some who's and where's. What who's do you see in this? That's an easy question, a verse like this.
Are there handouts this week?
There are handouts, yes. There are handouts. Thank you for asking.
Thank you.
But the answers are not in the handouts.
What was the question?
Tell me some who's in verse 1. There's verse 1. Tell me some who's that you see. Amraphel.
Uh-huh.
Arioch or something, yes.
These
are great names, aren't they?
Tidal.
Okay. So you see the names. That's some who's. Remember, we look at the questions. Who's, what, where, when, why, how. So what about where? Where are they from?
Shinar.
Elam. Nations or Goyim, some of your translations might have there, which is just the Hebrew word for nations. So here's the answers that of what we're looking at, just basic observation of who and where are they from. And that's how the narrative begins. Who are these people? Oh, by the way, what can you tell me about them? That's their names. They're all kings. That might surprise us, so many kings, but especially in those times, often a king was a king of just a city and its surrounding areas. So you'd have lots of, if you will, call city nations, city-states, if you will. And here's a little map that would help us to find those places. Again, when I'm looking at history of any sort and places are mentioned, I always kind of want to, it helps me so much if I can see it on a map. On this map, you see some major things listed. Those red lines were the highway system of the ancient world. And so here's where Shinar, you've heard of that before. Shinar. Where did I hear that? What have I heard about that in Genesis? Tower of Babel is in the plains of Shinar. Yes. There it is. So Babylon, that's where Chedorlaomer, or Amraphel, is king of Shinar, right?
Yeah.
And Chedorlaomer, when you see, by the way, in the Old Testament, the CH, Hebrew doesn't have a ch sound, like church. And so this is usually, it's a K sound, K, Chedorlaomer, unless it's immediately following a vowel. And so in all but one place in the Old Testament where this name is used, it's Chedorlaomer, and then it's Chedorlaomer. But if you called him Chedorlaomer, he wouldn't know who you were talking to. And that's Elam. Elam's a nation next to Persia in the ancient world. And so this is a pretty broad character. The other two we don't know for sure, but what we might say is they are Mesopotamian nations. Again, meso means between. Potomac is a river. So the area between the rivers of the Tigris and Euphrates, this region, is where these kings come from. And where are we talking about? All the way in little Israel over here. There's Jerusalem. Abram's down in this region. And we'll talk about where Lot is down there. So far, so good? So as you're reading through, I really encourage you, if you can, take a quick look at a map. And again, remember that the Bible app I showed you where you just put in the chapter, and every major geographic place is up there. Next, verse 2. They made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Adma, Shemember, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. And so, do you see the who's there? You might, you know, looking them out, but there are their names, right? Bera, Bersha, Shinab, Shemember. And we're not told the name of the next one. We're told he's the king of Bela. And where? Well, there's the cities as well. So there's your answer key of where they are, who they are. So notice I've got question marks next to Bela. So one thing we're told, the city Bela is also called Zoar. Later in Genesis, we'll see that name change. But there they are. So if I see the names, that again, I'm having a hard time. That doesn't do a whole lot for me. Yes, ma'am.
So it sounds like it kind of reads that Zoar is the name of the king. So it doesn't read that way?
No, that's actually the name of the city. Just telling you that actually that's the name of the city is Zoar.
Okay.
Good. You guys can see where you would see that. So I want to see it on a map, and so here again is a map that will give you some ideas of where they are. You see this little indicator here, possible location of Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, and Zeboim down here. Zoar is down, that's where Lot's going to flee to after Sodom and Gomorrah. Zoar, it's a little place. So we'll just, but we don't know exactly. After the destruction of this region, most people would place Sodom and the cities right by it down here in the southeastern part of the Dead Sea. Remember, there's the Jordan River heading up north. Bethel and Ai, right between there is where, back to Bethel, where the altar is. And so, Dead Sea here. Probably best to understand Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim are here. And they're all close together. Okay. Was the Dead Sea there at the time?
Wasn't dead, I guess.
There may have been some water, but remember, this is the incredibly fertile area that was like Eden, the garden of the Lord. It was like Egypt, because of that was before the judgment. You saw that in chapter 13. So the area has changed somewhat geographically. So we're told here, a quick count. How many Mesopotamian kings? 4. How many Valley of Siddim kings? 5. So 4 against 5. The Mesopotamian kings are outnumbered. So who and what questions for verses 3 and 4? I guess I didn't give you those verses, did I? How cheap. Grab a Bible. Not that one. Okay. Genesis chapter 14, verses 3 and 4. Someone read those out for me.
All be joined together in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Chedorlaomer, and the 13th year they rebelled.
Okay, so all these, those 5 kings, were together in the valley of Siddim. Let me go back. See this marker here? This is the valley of Siddim. So they're in this area together. And what are we told? That's who? Yes.
Could you orient us as to which of those cities we'd see on the map nowadays?
Beersheba for sure. Mamre, which is Hebron for sure.
Where would Jerusalem be?
Salem.
Salem. Jericho, you can see the ruins of Jericho today. Bethel. You can see ruins of some of these places today. So, here they are in this region, the five kings. That's who. What are we told about them? For 12 years, they were in what?
Servants.
They were servants, we're told, of Chedorlaomer. So who's the leading king of the Mesopotamian kings? Chedorlaomer from Elam. They were servants of him for 12 years, and then does it say it in here? It does, I think. That, and then what happened? Then they rebelled. What does it mean, do you think, that they were serving? What does it mean? What did it mean for them that they were serving the Elamite king?
Paid income tax.
Paid taxes, yes. And at least one commentator is noticing this region was rich in copper. That area of the world wasn't, and yet that's a helpful resource for weapon building. And so maybe they were paying in copper. Maybe they were paying in. Of course, you might pay in sheep, you might pay in all those kind of things. So for 12 years, basically you pay your tax or you're in big trouble, just like America. You pay your taxes or they will come and get you. And so finally, after a while, they said, forget it. We're going to tell them no. So in the 13th year, but it sounds like they're together agreeing. They called a council of these city-states. And said, let's have a conversation. I'm tired of paying taxes. Are you? Yes. We send this money. What do we get out of it? Oh, we're just sending money. Let's call their bluff. Let's tell them we're not sending any more money. That's the 13th year. Okay? So back, that's the who and what. And how did they serve and how did they rebel? They served by, we said, paying taxes. Rebelled by not paying taxes. Okay. Let's look at verses 5 and 7. So in the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him came and attacked the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Amim in Shaveh-Kiriataim, and the Horites in the mountain of Seir as far as El Paran, which is by the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to Ein-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and attacked all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. And again, when you read that, are you feeling blessed to be having some time in the Word here? I mean, this is one of those things that just doesn't do a whole lot for you, right? And about now, if you're doing your yearly reading, you're thinking, Lord, please forgive me. Can I skip this chapter? And again, it helps me, well, where are these people? And what's the significance? You can spend a lot of time studying that, but at least let's
look at it again. And this, so again, I just start pulling out maps and looking.
And so here's a picture of how they come down. They attack the Rephaim and Ashtaroth. Here's the Zuzim. I don't see Ham on this, but it talked about a city called Ham in there as well. Let me go back and. The Amim in Shaveh-Karnaim. So you see how they're basically coming down this area. This was one of those major roads, and they're conquering as they go. They come all the way down, so you can barely see it here, to a place that now is called Eilat. That would be a city. That's a resort you can go to. It's a great place right on the Red Sea. And it's incredible. You can be there, and you can see, look in one direction and see Saudi Arabia. You look in the other direction and see Jordan. You look in the other direction and see Egypt. And you look in the other direction and you see Israel. So it's kind of a interesting place. But so they come all the way down, conquering as they go, and finally approaching towards where our kings are. Does that make sense? So seeing it on a map, you see how there's a progression, and it's recorded in order as you follow the map. And so that's helpful for us. Does that give you, now what kind of information does that give you? just looking at the map, seeing that that coin quest, what are you noticing?
How powerful they were.
Oh, they're powerful. Yeah, I mean, they're sweeping across a region and conquering as they go. What else do you notice?
I don't know if they left garrisons behind them, but it would seem that they're surrounding Lot's territory and the Valley of Sidim.
Kind of saving them for last, aren't they? In other words, it's the Confederacy of rebels are going to get the last attack. Now, why would you hit them last? Maybe because you're that may surrounding or at least cutting off additional colleagues. How did you pay soldiers back then?
Spoil.
Well, if they're conquering all these countries, what do you think their backpacks feel like about now? Mm-hmm. And they're really going to conquer. Now, if they're really planning on hitting and just really, they're going to decimate the rebels. And so you might want to say, we'll hit that one last. Like when you go to the store, if you're going to hit a couple of stores, and say, well, okay, where is the frozen food? We'll hit that one last. And so they're saying, oh, maybe. I'm wondering if they're making this loop. And they're going to come back, hit them, and then go home. Let me just show you one other thing about these maps, and to give you a little perspective of what they're doing. Here is Elam. Here's where the boss is, Kedorlaomer. Omer. Notice they are sweeping this whole Fertile Crescent from here all the way. They're coming crashing down here and conquering all the way down to here. They're kind of taking control of the Fertile Crescent. And what they're basically doing is they're going to, you know, trying to control. This is a flow. These are the major highways. They're going to control commerce through this whole region from one port to the next. This is a massive international undertaking. By the way, this is I'm jumping ahead of myself. So just looking at the map, you start looking at that and saying, this is big. This is big. Verses 8 and 9. And the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. So again, you see, we're not naming kings, but we're redefining Bela, went out and joined together in the battle of Sidim, against Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of nations, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. So who, again, you see the various kings are all laid out there. What's happening in this passage?
Battle.
Big battle. This is the first war of the Bible that's recorded. And where's it happening?
Valley of Sidim.
Valley of Sidim, just below the Dead Sea. Do you notice we have to kind of struggle to just get through these names? But they keep listing them. Now, if I were telling the story, I might say the bad kings came out and attacked they're bad kings too, but the bad kings attacked the worser kings. I'm not sure how, but maybe that's why he's just naming them. But do you notice the repetition? What do you think he's trying to tell us as he keeps repeating these names of nations, these names of kings? What's he trying to say us? Tell us.
It's history.
This is historical fact. Yeah. This isn't some mythology. These are recorded events, real people, real nations. Excellent. Good.
I don't know if I missed it. Did you say who King of Nations is?
Well, I told you his name. Or no, did I tell you his name? I don't think his name is right.
Tidal.
Okay, yeah. But I told you his
king
name.
Where's nations?
So where's Goyim? I'm not sure.
Okay.
There's various theories. Some people even put it up in the Hittite Empire or modern day Turkey. I don't know. Jim.
Well, I was going to say, we've been told some significant things already. One is that Abraham's family is going to be a blessing to the nations. And so, there's a bunch of nations.
Yeah, here they come.
We know the sequel that Abraham's going to have a strategic role. And another thing is, we already know that Sodom is very wicked. And so I think, you know, you should say, well, they've got it coming.
Yeah, here comes the hammer. It's almost, the other side too is, you know, you just constantly naming, it's emphasizing this is a big, sweeping, international event, and yet Abram is God's channel of blessing to the nations. Also, who's reading the book? For whom was it written?
Israelites.
What's their context?
They're going
into the promised land. They're going to face a lot of
opposition.
Nations and opposition. And so here he's saying, look, here is a multinational big guy force. How's our hero going to do? And at this time, you know, the music plays, the curtain's closed, come back next week,
and we'll see what happens. Well, actually, we haven't gotten there just yet. Verses 10 to 13. Now, the valley of Siddim was full of asphalt. Maybe some of your translations have bitumen pits. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled. Some fell there, and the remainder fled to the mountains. So some may have fallen into the pits and either died or at least got stuck. Then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions, and they went their way. Who do you think took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and their provisions and went their way? The four kings, the Edomite coalition. And they also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. Now, okay, so first of all, we see there was a war. The big guys won, and they seized the loot. So far, so good. It was complicated by some of the kings and soldiers got stuck in the tar pits. So often in war, the terrain, some of the battles where the terrain killed more people than the weapons did. What's that last verse doing sitting there? Is he the only guy they took? They took all the goods and their provisions, and they went their way. So why is this last verse necessary? Where was our hero Lot when last we saw him?
In the city, at the city gates.
He pitched his tent towards Sodom, right? Now where is he? Before they came.
He's in Sodom.
Remember we talked about that progression. He was near Sodom, or toward Sodom. Now he's in Sodom. And so this is being told to us too. Why does this matter to us? Because frankly, all these kings are not the big picture, but Lot, he's in the big picture, and we're reminded he's Abram's brother's son. And remember, his brother died. He's kind of the nephew taken under the wing by Abram. So this all connects to Abram, God's man. And he's taken everything. I'm struck by this word goods. We've seen this, it may be translated differently, a variety of times already in Genesis. When Abram came from Haran, he brought all his goods. When they left Egypt, they had lots of goods. They had so many goods and so many herds and all that, remember? They had to split up. And Lot went towards Sodom because he thought it would help multiply his goods. How did that work out? He's lost it all. He's lost it all. Well, we might think, well, that's the best way. Well, we've got to split up because there's just not enough pasturage for our herds. They split up, and he went to Sodom, He went into Sodom. He lived in Sodom. And as a result, he lost everything. There's a way that seems right to man. The end is death. It seemed like a good plan for him, but he was not thinking in God's way. So here's a picture of, again, what happens. So they come down, they make the attack, Valley of Sidim, they battle the five kings. The five kings are defeated by the four. And then these start heading off and with all their loot. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram, the Hebrew, for he dwelt by the terebinth trees of Mamre the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and brother of Aner, and they were allies with Abram. Now when Abram heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his 318 trained servants who were born in his house, and they went in as far in pursuit as far as Dan. So who's what character, what names do we see now that we should notice? Abram. Good, thank you. Give the easy answer first.
Mamre.
Who else? Eshcol and Aner. Or honor. Okay? You know, you wonder if you're reading fast, ain't there or something. So whatever, let's look at where it's called. Abram, he's called the Hebrew. So here's the, I think the first time they're titled this. This is a name literally that either is he's a descendant of Eber, or it means one who crossed the river, one who came across. So this seems to be the name he's assigned by the nations, by the Gentiles that look out of him. He's the one who came from across the river. He came from the distant land. And then there's, and he dwelt by the tents of terebinth trees of Mamre, the Amorite. Oh, these oak trees belong to a person, Mamre, who's an Amorite. We'll hear about Amorites later on, but that tells us something about their... They're not Canaan. He's not necessarily one of these Canaanites. And he's got a couple brothers as well. Okay? And they are literally... They have a covenant with Abram. So, here are these significant individuals who apparently have a mutual defense alliance. So when Abram heard that his brother, it was Lot his brother, but as good as, his relative, his kin, was taken up, would he have gone to go rescue Sodom? Probably not. But he went to rescue Lot, because he's family. He armed his 318 servants who were born in his own house. Do you see a who in that crowd? In that phrase?
Servants.
Okay, tell me about his servants. How many were there? 318 servants.
Born in his
house. Now what is that? What's the significance of that?
Ownership?
Second generation. Who said that? Yes, second generation. Why would he only choose the born ones? Trained, maybe more loyal because they're born in his household and loyal, faithful servants. How many servants does he have? These are the ones born in his house. And these are the males. He's got to have at least 1,000 servants in his household. Remember, this is like a business. This is a pretty good-sized business he's running. And he takes 300 plus. They are trained, and they can fight. Remember, their main duty seems to be shepherding. Can you think of any other shepherds that were also pretty good at fighting?
David.
Remember? Hey, I could take on a lion. Well, I could take on a giant. But good with a sling, good with weapons. He gathers up those 300 and his allies, we're told. And they went in pursuit as far as Dan. Now, where's Dan?
Way up north.
When in Bible, often you will hear Israel referred to as from Dan to Beersheba, from north to south. And so they're going a quick run up this route. I'm gonna suspect the most natural thing is they would have come in, conquered, and headed up east of the Jordan River. That's the way they came in. He must have come up either joining them or coming along, tracking along them. But around Dan, he catches up with them. That's probably 80, 85 miles. Maybe 100. And so they catch up with them. He divided his forces against them by night, and he and his servants attacked them and pursued them as far as Hobah, which is north of Damascus. And so he brought back all the goods and also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as the women and the people. So they seized they took everybody. So where did this happen? And what happened? He chased them, we saw, as far as Dan. Then how does it, what happens? Pardon me?
North of Damascus.
North of Damascus, as far as it goes. What kind of battle is it?
A running battle.
A running battle, yeah. It's a what? A nighttime battle. Do you think they had night vision goggles? Nighttime battle is a hard thing in that part of the world. Unless there's a moon, you don't see anything. I remember one time we were on a hike, with my other college students, and this gal, we were up in Masada, and she was going to jump up and sit on a wall. It was dark enough, her face went straight into the wall, and it was awful. But I mean, it's dark. So you can imagine a nighttime battle. It says he knows his strategy. He divided his forces, so he hit them from several angles in the dark by surprise. What do you think the Elamite forces were doing when they attacked? Sleeping, maybe even enjoying all the good stuff they got out of Sodom, Gomorrah. But they were probably just going through the trinkets. Enjoying a good meal, anything but ready for battle.
Campfires where they can be
found. Yeah, campfires, probably lots of noise. It's, you know, I've read some biblical accounts where it says there was so much confusion, the army ended up fighting each other. I can't tell you the number of times just in the last year I've read about battles in more modern times where that's exactly what happened. Like there was at least one or two battles in the War of 1812 where exactly you end up with Americans firing on Americans and in the confusion. Or you think of in the Civil War, you think of Stonewall Jackson was killed by his own troops. They thought he was an orderer. I mean, it's the confusion of battle happens all the time. So they hit him in the dark, in the confusion. His 300 plus and his allies, and they did what these four farmers did what five kings couldn't do. They routed the Mesopotamian giants, and he brought everything home. Now, let's imagine you have been, put it on a map here. So here's the picture. They came down. They attacked. Here's Sodom, Gomorrah, Zoar. Then they came back up. And as they did, Abram followed. He caught up with them about Dan. They came to this place called Hobah, Damascus. It's northwest of Damascus. I was reading one guy who wrote a book on the battles of the Bible. He's also a historian of modern battles. And he said, oh, this could very well be the same place the Australian forces caught up with, I can't remember what forces, and in this particular gorge, it's a great place, ambushes have happened there all over history. Maybe it was the same place, but here's the point. They hit them fast, hard, in the dark, conquered them, and brought back all the loot. Now, here's the question. If you're not a historian of geography or military issues, let's just say you've just been given the assignment. I want you to stand up and preach a sermon on Genesis 14, 1 to 6. Or you're reading your Bible, you're 3/4 of the way through your cup of coffee, it's about time to get on with other things. What applications what lessons do you start taking away from this book? Just some ideas of where you might want to explore. What are some implications? Let me write these down. I'll need them. Yes.
God can use heathen nations to accomplish his purpose.
God can use heathen nations. What are you thinking in particular? What purpose was accomplished?
Well, I mean, eventually, I was thinking more of like the judgment of and rebuke of Lot for, I mean, he's mixed up in Sodom, and Sodom is getting judged, and he's getting judged because he keeps choosing to keep going the wrong way. And sometimes the Lord doesn't have to use a good Christian person to rebuke you. He may use someone who doesn't even know the Lord.
Very good. Like when Pharaoh verbally rebuked Abram, now we have these armies militarily rebuking these pagans, and Lot. And again, Lot, what are you doing with them? You thought this would be a better off for your finances? But what a rebuke. What are you doing with these people? And because you share in their faith. What else? Good. Yes.
And not by might, not by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. And here's Abraham, or Abram, he's not the guy going with his tent towards Sodom. He's the guy building altars and worshiping the Lord. And he does what these four or five kings can't accomplish. He does it in the power of the Lord.
God, one plus God is always a majority. So God, by God's strength, he prevails.
They mentioned his goods enough that maybe you could look at it as when your things determine the decisions you make, and you're making poor decisions based on how can I get more things, it leads to trouble.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that goods is again and again brought up here. I think the rescue is to indicate God can take care of the goods. Your job is to seek the Lord and trust him for the goods. Again, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. That stuff will get taken care of. And so, Abram, you don't see him chasing after the goods, do you? He's chasing after his brother. Yes?
Yeah, I'm just reminded of Revelation 21:8. Where it says the cowardly, unbelieving, and then has a list of several of people who wind up, groups of people who wind up in the lake of fire.
Yeah.
You know, think of that proverb. It says the wicked flees when no man pursues, but the righteous are bold as a lion. That this took courage. And you might think Abraham's a little bit weak after his scene down in, you know, with Pharaoh, but this is, to me, shows great faith in God, faith in God's promises to him that he would do this.
And he's probably what? Maybe 5, approaching 90 at this point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, faith, but not in his strength.
Yeah, and faith that led to courage.
I suspect as he launched out, he didn't know he would win, but he knew it was the right thing. And often, you know, we don't do something necessarily because we know this is going to get the outcome I want, but I do it because it's right. And he knew it was the right thing to do. But it was a courageous faith. No question. I mean, these were mighty kings. No, and I think what's one of the things, look at all the ones they conquered. Nation after nation after nation. And who beats them? A homeless guy. He comes out from underneath his bridge and conquers these great and mighty kings. But who really did it? The Lord did. Good. What else? May I say, too, the next section is especially powerful. We stop here on Sunday, but the next section is a really significant. Again, the goods continue in the theme of the following and the rest of the chapter. And we'll see where his heart is about goods. And you have my permission to look ahead if you want. But there's some good things here about courage, doing what's right. We see the hazard of hooking up to the train of the world and thinking that's what's going to get us ahead. It gets Lot into a lot of trouble. We also see, what did God say? I will bless you. I will curse those who curse you. I'll bless those who bless you. I will bless you. We see God's blessing in Abram's life. And we see him on the international scene. I'll make you a great nation. He's acting like he's the leader of a great nation.
Sorry, this is a little bit of a tangent, but sure. Is there any indication as to what the population of, like, Sodom was?
Good question. What was the population of Sodom? I don't know. I'm going to have to think about that. It's not like what we think of. Normally, we might think in terms of thousands, not hundreds of thousands. You know, I think, but I'll do some thinking on that. Good.